Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my absolute pleasure to have as my guest, Jason Tuttle. Jason Tuttle is a married father of two kids with multiple physical and cognitive disabilities. His family has lived a life of disability and medical challenges for 16 years and counting. Unfortunately, on January 28, 2022, Jason's son suddenly and unexpectedly passed away due to issues related to his medical special needs. Since that day, he decided to start journaling. It is through his journaling that Jason has decided to be on a mission to help others, especially men, deal with their untapped emotions relating to and dealing with grief. Specifically through his Letters to Zachary Facebook blog, as well as his blog on other social media platforms. It is Jason's goal to help people to see that it is okay to be vulnerable enough to share emotions in a safe environment. Jason, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we were just before we went on the air, we were talking about the weather in Georgia. Right now you're getting some unseasonably cool weather from what I understand.
Yeah, today's only supposed to hit 75. And normally in years past, at least the last couple of years, at this point in the year, we've been like in the 90s. And so for the last several summers, it's just been brutal down here. In fact, every summer up to this summer I've gone, we've got to have a mild summer. And we can't keep having these just ridiculously hot summers. It wouldn't be so much that it hit 90 degrees. It's the fact that we get the humidity on top of it. Yeah. And when you get 90 plus degree humidity on top of 90 degrees, it makes it feel like 95, 96, 97, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that I can do without.
So can I.
But anyway, now that we've done the weather forecast, let's get right down to it.
Okay.
First of all, Jason, please tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path, your life passions.
Okay, so I have been married. This year will be 21 years, if my math is correct. Yeah, 21 years. My wife and I decided about a year after we got married that we wanted to have kids. Even though I'm not Southern by birth, I've lived in the South most of my life, and so I consider myself Southern. My wife, on the other hand, was born up in Western Massachusetts. She's got family in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, all that area up there. If you think of this stereotype of someone from like Boston and all, that would be my father-in-law. Has the accent that'll never go away. So with that being said, she was born a cradle Catholic. And as for a lot of families up there, most of the families up there are very large families. So when we decided to have kids, my wife said, initially she goes, I'd like to have four kids. And my first response was, "Ooh, let's have the first one and then we'll talk." And I had always thought that we were probably going to have two or three. Traditional kind of size of a family. And so after about a year being married, we decided we're going to start trying, and it didn't take us long to get her to get pregnant. And it was actually her hairstylist that pointed out that she was pregnant before even she knew, which I just found that to be funny. And she calls and tells me, and we're both, as you can imagine, excited. And she asked me, she goes, "Well, what if we have a child with medical needs?" And my response was, "Well, if we have a child with medical needs, then we're going to have one." I don't believe in the alternative method that some people use when issues like that arise. So we'll just deal with it as it comes. Everything was fine. We got through the first trimester of pregnancy. Everything was okay. And then we got to the week 20 appointment, which any woman knows that's the appointment where you find out the sex of the child. So we go into this appointment. We playfully go back and forth because she doesn't want to know because it's life's last great mystery. I do want to know because I'm a planner. I'm the one painting the nursery and I don't want to like paint in neutral colors, that kind of thing. So we go back and forth and the ultrasound tech's doing her thing. And she gets to that point. She goes, I'm about to the point to find out the sex of the child. Do you want to know? So we playfully go back and forth. And honestly, the next thing she said, she probably shouldn't have said it. It should have been the doctor, but she said it anyway. She goes, I need to know the sex of the child because I found an issue. And we said, we want to know the sex of the child. We found out we were having a boy. And we said, can you tell us what the issue is? And she goes, no. She said, the doctor will have to based on what I'm going to show him via the ultrasound. And I said, why did you need to know whether it was a boy or a girl? She said, if it's what I think it is, she said, it's rare in boys and rarer in girls. So I needed to know whether it was a boy or a girl and you're having a boy. Okay, fine. From that point forward, we start seeing a perinatologist, which for those that don't know, that's a high risk OBGYN, if you will. And so we start seeing him from that point all the way up to the point which my wife had the C-section. You learn in this life, this special needs life that we're getting into, you run across two types of doctors. You run across either the one that doesn't want to tell you anything unless they have concrete proof because they don't want to be sued, or you find the other type of doctor that's going to tell you every possibility under the sun to cover themselves so that they don't get sued. And so we got in there and he told us like four or five like major medical issues that he thought our son was going to have, and two or three of them actually came true, but the other ones did not. So we get to the point that my wife has the C-section. She gives birth to our son. We see him about 30 seconds and they take him up to the NICU in the hospital that we're in. I go up to the NICU and the doctor goes, your son was born with a condition called Eagle-Barrett syndrome, or more affectionately known as prune belly. It's a rare condition. And so he said, what's going to happen is we're going to monitor him overnight. The local children's hospital on the north side of Atlanta is going to come down and get him and transport him up there because they're more equipped to deal with these types of issues. I said, okay. So they came and got him the next day. My wife was able to see her son a little better before they transport him, and then off he went. Typically these days for women, they give you about 3 days to recover. And essentially, for lack of better words, they kick you out the door. My wife, because of everything going on, recovered in 2 days, and we were up there on the third day, which is a testament to her because of just the massive kind of surgery that a C-section is. So from this point forward, it's like the hammer drops. We find out he's got a Eagle-Barrett syndrome. We find out he's got severe neurological delays. Even though he was 15, he functioned about 4 to 6 years old. He had epilepsy. Of the six different kinds of seizures, he had two different kinds of them. He was nonverbal. He was essentially wheelchair bound, although if I would hold him up under his arms, he could walk with me, but by himself. Now, if you put him on the ground, he could army crawl as fast as lightning anywhere, but like to walk upright, no, he never really did that. In the first about year to 2 years, we found out about all of these medical issues that he had that just kind of sucker punched us, if you will, and we had to learn on the fly. After my wife had recovered, she wanted to have all of our kids before a certain age because she was starting to get up to where it was getting starting questionable just age-wise for a woman about secondary issues that might happen just due to age. And so you can imagine the flack we got from our family when we said we're going to have a second child after everything that we found out about our son. And a lot of our family didn't want us to have one just because they're just like, why would you want to possibly double all of the issues that you already have? I researched everything. And after everything I researched, it basically came out that even though my son did have all these issues, there's no guarantee that your second child will have anything. Rare issues or even the common issues they had, there's no guarantee. So we decided to have what turned out to be our daughter. And initially when she was born, she was the normal child, if you will. And the reason why I say that was because we were basing her development on our son's development. And what we found out about 6 months in was she was delayed as well. Although at the time I didn't want to hear that answer just because of everything that was going on. And it was our pediatrician who has a special needs child that said, I tend to agree with the OT that said that, but you may want to see neurology for your daughter. Long story short, my daughter has all of the exact same issues as my son, except for the rare Eagle-Barrett syndrome.
Can I interrupt just for 2 seconds? But I just, before I forget.
Okay.
What is your son's name?
Zachary.
Yeah, Zachary. Okay. What is Eagle-Barrett syndrome? I know you said something about it earlier. Can you just briefly explain for our audience what that is?
Sure. It's right now, it's a rare condition. It's got, as far as I know, doctors don't know the official cause of it. It's 1 in 40,000 births. It's, as far as I last remember, it was around kidney issues. They don't know the official cause as to what starts all of it. So for example, my son was born with one kidney. That one kidney, due to having fluid back up into it while in utero, sustained some damage. And so because of that, the question after he was born was, how much good kidney does he have left to sustain normal function the bigger he gets into adulthood? Because a lot of Eagle-Barrett syndrome children have massive kidney issues, like kidney transplant kind of issues. And so he was born with one kidney. Now, the main characteristic of Eagle-Barrett syndrome is the fact that my son was not born with any abdominal muscles. He had no core abdominal muscle. So like I could lay him on the floor and the only protection between his internal organs and the outside world was his skin and the fascia that was holding it together. So like I could lay him on the floor and I could literally point and touch his lower intestine, his upper intestine. I could look on his back and touch his kidney, all those organs there I could touch just by barely pressing on the outside. On top of that, with the Eagle-Barrett syndrome, he had normal breathing. However, he had a diminished lung capacity. What I mean by that is you and I have the core abdominal muscles there. So when we get a pneumonia or bronchitis or something to that effect, we have that foundation there that we can press off of in our body to get that force to cough something up. He didn't have that. And so what would ultimately happen was when he would get sick and get a chest cold, if I didn't catch it fast enough, ultimately I was running him up to the ER at our children's hospital and we were getting admitting. And typically that it was anywhere from 5 to 12 days every time we went in there. On top of that, Eagle-Barrett syndrome kids have abnormally large bladders that don't give them the sensation to go to the bathroom. So what I would have to do at least the first 4 or 5 years of his life was I would have to give him a catheter every 4 hours to drain his bladder. Because if I didn't, it would get so full that it would become painful. So I would have to make sure that I would drain him as much as I could so that we could reduce the risk of having a urinary tract infection. So all of that combined is Eagle-Barrett syndrome. Now, granted, I was very fortunate that throughout my son's life, we never had any major kidney issues.
That sounds like a lot going on physically with him.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it required a lot of intensive care, a lot of hypervigilance to make sure that you could ensure a quality of life for him.
Yes, I got almost from the start, I got really good at reading nonverbal cues and body language. Like I could get to a point where I could just look at him and I could tell whether something was going on or not. He wouldn't even have to tell me. I could tell by his mannerisms and just how he was acting. And my son was nonverbal. He could make sound and he could that kind of thing. But to say words, no, not so much. So it wasn't like he was mute. We believe that something neurologically was keeping him from actually making the words. he had the air coming out because at one point through speech, they're just like, because he doesn't have any core muscles, we don't know if he's getting enough air out through his vocal cords to be able to make sound. If you ever heard him squeal in excitement, you would know that was not the case at all. So, yeah.
Yeah, it just sounds like he had his own way of communicating that you uh-huh. and your wife could understand. So, again, you mentioned with your daughter, she had a lot of the same issues as Zach.
Yes.
Anything else that you want to add to that as well about your daughter?
Even though my daughter had similar issues, it was my son that was more medically fragile. It was my son that I was more in and out of the hospital with. I would say of the percentage, it would probably be 90% my son in the hospital and about 10% my daughter in the hospital. Just because of the combination of issues with my son and his rare condition just made him more medically fragile. My daughter, we had almost two years after to the day from my son, and genetics has still not been able to tell us why my son and daughter had identical issues almost 2 years to the day apart, and they can't figure out what the connection is.
One of the things I've learned is that sometimes we have to live with unanswered questions. And I've learned that as I've gone into my own personal journey of loss, and that there's certain questions that there's no answers to. And so we have to learn to live with the ambivalence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know Zach is the centerpiece of what you do today.
Yes.
Fast forwarding to January 28th. That would be 2022. Talk about his life up until then and talk about that pivotal day.
Okay. So for the first about 5 years for us, it was a lot of trial and error and learning, meaning all of the issues were starting to come out. So after about year five or six, I had seen everything enough to where when something popped up, it didn't surprise me. There was one time I had him in the store in one of the grocery stores down here. He was in the cart, and in the middle of the store, he goes into a full-on seizure. And he starts doing the typical, like a grand mal seizure, where he's twitching and he's rigid and people are freaking out around me and going, what's going on? That kind of thing. Now, understand, I have a weird sense of humor. And especially in moments like these, I had this lady just freak out going, what's going on? What's going on? I said, oh, he's having a seizure. She's just like, you're not going to do anything. And I said, the medication I have for him, I have to wait at least 5 minutes before I give it to him. And that medication is a rectal medication. So if you want me to take him out of this cart, drop him to the floor, drop his pants down, and stick something up his rear side to do that, I'll do it right in front of you. But until 5 minutes, I can't do anything. And I said, so he'll be all right. And I rolled off with it in the cart as he was still seizing. And this lady, I could see in my peripheral vision, she was just freaking out. And I'm just like, it'll be all right. And at the point where she asked me, it had been about a minute. So, but it was like another minute and he snapped out of it. And I was timing it at the time. So it wasn't like I was ignoring him, but she was just freaking out. So that's just my weird sense of humor when I would have people come up and that had no real clue of what was going on. But so once we got to year six, it was basically pretty routine for a lot of years. I would periodically have hospital stays and emergency moments in the sense of I'd take them up to the hospital, they'd check them out, I'd come home. Nothing like I'd have to be admitted. He did in 2014, he had a major midsection reconstruction surgery that really helped him out called an abdominoplasty. I could go in the details about that, but it's long and drawn out. It basically just reconstructs his midsection to give more support is the easiest way to describe it. And then in June or July of 2021, he had a spinal fusion surgery. Several months before we took him in, because I saw a slight curve in his spine, and I literally went in to see if it could get checked out to see what I needed to do. Little did I know he had a 90% curve in his spine. And so the orthopedist said, he's going to need spinal fusion surgery. He said, this is not one of those things that's going to get better. It will get worse over time. So he had that spinal fusion surgery. He had two rods and 22 pins put in his spine. in that surgery. We were in and out in 3 days. And that really surprised me at the quick turnaround, but they explained their justification for it, so I was okay with it. But so with that being said, January 28th comes up. Excuse me. What had happened was I sent them to school that morning and No issues. Didn't think anything about it. Because they're both in wheelchairs, I have a lift bus that literally comes to my front door. Kids came home. I got them in. I did our normal routine, got them changed, got them bathed, that kind of stuff. And so typically on most nights, what would happen would be I'd put my daughter to bed first, typically about 7:30. And then I would keep my son up about another hour and a half after that with my wife and I in the bedroom, just to give him some one-on-one time. I love my daughter, but she can be a lot to handle. She's just intense. It's just her nature. And I love her to death, but there were times I could look at my son and he'd look at me and go, I need a break. And so we would always do that just to let him know, to give him one-on-one time with us. So we'd bring him into the bedroom. That night I'd fed him one of his favorite meals and he ate like a horse, and we brought him in the bedroom. We watched TV with him. And so it got to be about time that to get him ready for bed. So my wife got our electric toothbrush and brushed the teeth, and she went a little bit too far and gagged him. And he threw up a little bit, and it surprised us a little bit, but I was just like, maybe you went a little too far. You hit his gag reflex and he had something in his system and it just came up. Didn't think much about it. Got him cleaned up, put him to bed, went on about our evening like we normally do. That night he was up and down most of the night, which is unusual for him. At this point, I'm in the tail end of being a stay-at-home parent. And so I'm at home at this point, and the next morning, I text the teacher because he's in a self-contained classroom, and I go, hey, Zachary wasn't feeling well overnight. I don't know what he has. If it's contagious, I'm going to keep him home because I don't want to spread it to the classroom. I'll let you know later on today to see what I'm going to do, because we're butting up towards a holiday. She was great. She was just like, great. Thank you for letting me know. Just let me know later today. Okay, fine. Got my daughter off to school. And then that day I put him in his favorite chair and I told him all day, I'm just like, buddy, you can take a nap. I know you're exhausted. You didn't sleep well last night. And he refused to take a nap that day. It was a Thursday. And I said, buddy, look at that couch. All I'm going to be doing is sitting on the couch on my laptop, getting some work and some things done. You're not missing anything. Still refused all day. And so that evening, I made the executive decision. I go, I'm going to keep him out tomorrow, which is a Friday. It'll butt up into the week, and then we'll have two more days on top of that. So I texted the teacher. She said, fine, see you on Monday. Put him down that night. He immediately gets quiet. Don't think anything bad. I just figure he's just exhausted because he didn't sleep the night before. He didn't sleep all day. So he was quiet all night that night. We got my daughter up that next morning, got her off to school. I went into his room, say about 8:30, and he was there and he was aware and he was awake. And normally he bounces and gets excited when we walk in the room, and he just laid there. And that didn't really strike me, but I thought maybe he just woke up and he's just waking up. So I walk around to his right side and I notice this dark green streak of fluid just out of his side of his mouth. And I go, huh. The only thing that I know that's dark green in your body's bile, and it coming out of your mouth is not a good thing. So I get him up and he's really floppy, like he can't hold himself up. And that didn't even strike me as odd, because I had a couple of times in the past where he'd been that way. And I thought, well, maybe you're really sick. I need to really start looking at you and see what I need to do. I get him out in the living room. I go through my mental protocol of what I need to do. I cath his bladder. I do all these different things. Nothing seems to be doing anything. Now, the one thing I do notice is his midsection is rock hard, like hard to the cinder block wall, rock hard. And it catches my attention. And I go, this is unusual. I don't know what this is. And so he's just laying there. And I look at my wife, and it was honestly just a hunch decision. I went, you know what? I'm going to take him up to the hospital. Something's not right. And I don't know what it is. So she goes, okay. I get him dressed, get him in his wheelchair, get him in the van, and I'm driving off. I'm doing like 90 up the interstate just because I don't know what's going on. So I get up on the interstate, going, getting towards the center of Atlanta, and I can see him. He's lurching his midsection up like he's uncomfortable, and then he looks like he might be falling asleep. And in my head, I'm thinking, I need to keep him awake. If you get a concussion, you don't want to fall asleep right afterwards.
Yep.
And so I go, I need to keep him awake. I don't know what's going on. So the whole time I'm going up there, I'm snapping my fingers and I'm going, hey, buddy, stay with me. Stay with me. Come on, man. You got to stay awake. I said, I know you're uncomfortable. We're going to the hospital. Stay with me. And so we're driving. And anybody that knows Atlanta knows that Atlanta traffic is horrible. It's terrible. So I go through the center of Atlanta, and right, I'm getting on the north side of Atlanta, and the interstate I have to go on right as I'm getting onto it to get to the state road I've got to go to get to the hospital. The sign's lit up and it says major wreck, all lanes blocked. And I'm just, at this point, I'm freaking out in my head because I don't know what's going on. I don't know. It's looking really serious at this point, but I can't tell what it is. And so for about 15 minutes, we crawl in traffic and I'm just freaking in my head, which I don't typically do with my son. And so we finally get through it and I get to the front, and I don't know if they waved us through, but I floored it because that DOT worker doesn't know what's going on in my van. I get to the hospital, I get him out to the van, and he's really flopping, and this catches my attention. I'm just like, ooh, something's really not right. So I finally get up in the ER and I skip the line. And as I'm skipping the line, the security guard comes over to me to say, hey, you need to get in line. You can't skip everybody. And before he says anything, I go, he's not breathing. I need help now. And so he immediately changes his tune. He snaps his fingers at the nurse. I've been in this hospital probably 30 times. And this is the first time I went to a full run back into the ER, into one of the trauma rooms. So we get in there. Instinctually, I get him out of his chair. I put him on the table and I back out of the way because I want to stay in there, let them do their job and stay in there so that I can tell the doctors what's going on, because he's nonverbal. He can't tell them. And so luckily there's another ER trauma room right next to us that's empty. And so they're just like, just stand in there. And I said, okay. And so they move it. They immediately cut his clothes off. They immediately start chest compressions on him. The one thing that struck me that caught my attention was right as they got in there, they took something and literally drilled it into his knee. It was like a port or something. A normal lucid person, if you were to take a drill and drill something into your bone, would come up off the table because of the intense pain that would produce. He didn't even flinch a muscle. And so I later found out it was some sort of port that they put in them that could immediately get some, either antibiotics or something in them. And so they do that. They do chest compressions. And so the head ER doc, the female, comes over to me. She goes, to the minute, how long has he been this way, to the best of your recollection? I said, with the drive and this, I said about 30, 35 minutes, plus or minus about 5 minutes. And she goes, okay. She goes off Bark's order. She comes back and she goes, tell me the reason why you brought him up here. What were the signs, the symptoms, that kind of thing? And I told her everything. She goes, okay. She goes back over and Bark's orders. And I'm watching them. And they get out the paddles. Now, the traditional paddles, like the old plastic-looking ones, you put the gel on it and they rub them together and they yell, clear, that kind of thing. Nowadays, it's two sticky pads they put on you, on your heart and your side, and they just press a button. And so they go over there and they put that on him, and I hear clear and they press the button. And just like a TV show, I literally see him raise off the table. I mean, it's very graphic. And even though I didn't say it or didn't react to it, I knew in that moment, I was just like, he is not coming back. Now, granted, from that point forward, they continued CPR for another 45 continuous minutes. In fact, I told them after we left, I said, I am impressed at the level in which y'all went to try to save my son. Despite what has happened, I'm impressed. I never thought it would go this long to do this. But so they go through everything. The doctor comes up to me and goes, she said, we can shock him again. It's your decision. I don't think it'll do anything more. And I said, this is out of my wheelhouse. Do what you think is medically necessary. So they do it again, nothing happens. And at that point, they pronounce them. And as you can imagine, I turn away and I go into the empty trauma room, and I have a moment to myself, and then I regain my composure when I'm there. And I, as a man and just as a father that's dealt with special needs issues with my kids all their lives, at that point I go into, I just compartmentalize it, because I'm just like, I've got to know this information, that kind of thing. Before all that happens, I have to call his mother, who thinks he just went up here for something to be admitted, that her son is dead on a table. I will never forget that sound she made when I told her that. I then had to call my mother, his grandmother, and tell her the same thing. I'll never forget the sound she made. And then, like I told my wife, I said, call your parents, have them drive you up here. You are not in a state to drive. Have them drive you. And she goes, okay, and she regains her composure, that kind of thing. I will say, later on down the road, my mother told me one day, she said, when you called me, you were eerily calm. She said, there was no emotion in your voice. There was no inflection in your voice. She said, you were almost stoically calm when you called me. She said, it caught my attention. I said, in that moment, I had to be. I said, that was my option. Essentially, what happened next was the care team came in and we went over what's going to happen next. Is an autopsy going to happen? Who do I need to call for, like a funeral home, that kind of stuff. And so we went over all that. I will say the hardest thing in this whole process that I had to do was, wife came up, we spent about an hour with him, and then we finally told the ER team, I said, we're going to go home. We've got to contact a funeral home, that kind of thing. We drove home 60 miles silently the entire way home. It was the longest van ride I think I've ever had.
Yeah, I was just listening to everything in terms of the details and the last day of his life. It's amazing. Like for me, my daughter Janine, and I call it transition to a new existence over 21 years ago.
Yeah.
I will forever, Jason, remember the last day of her life.
Oh, yeah.
I will remember everything that happened. I'll remember who was around. That'll be the difference 21 years later, is that it's become a part of me, and I understand that is now part of my experience, and it doesn't rock me as emotionally, but I can imagine in the beginning, it's like you relive that day and relive that day and relive that day and relive that day. And I think a lot of times we need to do that so that in some way the story can come to its fruition and we can integrate that into who we are. So you were talking about compartmentalization. I guess this gets into the next question I got.
Perfect.
Is in terms of what do you want the audience to know about how men deal with grief? I know compartmentalization is a big part of that.
Oh, yeah.
And I know for me, I'm going to throw this out there before I turn it over to you, is one of the myths of grief is that a lot of times individuals feel that men don't experience feelings as much as their women counterparts do. Guaranteed, I think we feel feelings just as intensely. We just deal with it differently. With that, I'm going to throw it out there. What is it that we need to know so that we can support males who are grieving?
Honestly, with men, me included, I may not be to the extreme end of it on the male side of this, but I am part of it. I think a lot of women don't understand how men can flip a switch and turn things on and that. It's how we're programmed. We have learned since birth that, sure, you can experience this, whatever it is, but we only have a short amount of time. So we've learned that if we don't have enough time in that moment, we'll put it to the side, put it on the mental checklist, and we'll come back to it later. It's like I was saying when I was in the hospital, even though I just dealt with the most devastating thing a parent could deal with, I needed to know how to get him home. Yes, I was going to grieve. Yes, I was going to have emotion with it. And I did a lot. But in that moment, it wouldn't have done me any good to be an emotional, sobbing kind of person when I needed to know some very pertinent facts so that I could get my son home. To me, it was once I got him home, then I could relax enough to be able to grieve. Now, when it comes to men are the stereotype, the first emotion we all experience is anger. It's how men are programmed. So Yeah, I was angry for a while afterwards. This wasn't supposed to happen. This is not the life I was supposed to have. This wasn't supposed to happen to my son. How am I supposed to write an obituary for a 15-year-old child? He's barely lived a life, whereas at that time I was 45. How has he really lived a life in 15 years when I've tripled that? Men are very emotional. It's just we have been learned to be very selective of who we show it to. And when we are emotional, women are intense, but when men get intense with emotion, you can ramp that up by 100. Mm. It's how we operate. And there's a lot of men out there that if they're going to do something, it's not just a little bit, it's 0 to 150%. It's all or nothing. And that's how some of these men, those people that cope with, say, drinking, that's why some men are okay doing a little bit, and some men go from nothing to drinking all the time.
Yeah.
So it's just the men's mentality. The other thing that, like, women need to know is we have been taught from birth that, sure, you can have emotion, but it needs to be short, it needs to be brief, and you need to move on. You are the strength, you are the foundation, you are the protector, the provider, whatever you want to call. You can't be sitting here in a corner and being sad and emotional when you've got all these other tasks that you've got to do, societally speaking. And then I've told people before, I said, I don't know if this is a controversial take on it or not. I said, but society has taught men that women's feelings come first no matter what. And here's the example I give. I said, if you don't believe me, I said, I can point out any house on my street, and I guarantee you at least a couple of them will have the sign, happy wife, happy life, hanging in their house. Mm-hmm. It's a societal norm. And I said, don't get me wrong, I'm thrilled when my wife is happy. I'm thrilled that she can be happy and I can provide things to make her happy. But when it comes to emotion, it's always the woman first. When it came to the loss of our son, if she wanted to be emotional first, I would be more than happy to do that. And I would deal with it at a certain point afterwards. I'd give my attention to her. And then when she was in a better place at that moment, then I could let loose somewhere else. And so I don't have any problem with that. But I'm old enough to be of a generation where we lived in the rub some dirt on it, tape it up and walk it off. Are you injured or are you hurt? And so I'm of that generation. And women need to understand all of this plays into that.
And the other thing with men is that a lot of times men don't have a direct access to their emotions because mm-hmm. we're in our heads a lot. But if I ask a guy what they're thinking, they could tell me how they're feeling as a result of how they're thinking. Men, sometimes you got to go through a back door to get there, but you can get there. And I think it's just a matter of understanding everybody's respective grieving styles. But thanks for that, Jason. Thanks.
Certainly.
That's a good analogy. Let me ask you, what has your son Zachary's life taught you about your own life?
Oh, wow. I've actually been asked this before, and my initial first response is always the same thing. He did not choose the life that he was given. He was born into it. He did not choose any of the medical issues. He did not choose any of the adversities that he has or had. And so he came into this world. All of the things that we think are hard, this was normal life to him. He didn't know any different. So, for example, when I would have to give him a catheter, most guys would go, hey, what are you doing with that going down in that area? My son, on the other hand, would literally put his hands behind his head and go, all right, big guy, let's do this. It wouldn't faze him. He taught me how to deal with just massive amounts of adversity, because ultimately that's what his cognitive and physical disabilities are. In the simplistic form, it's just adversity. It's learning how to deal with it and either get around it or deal with it and overcome it. And so I tell people, he was the most laid back child. Even in the hospital, there was only two or three times he was like to the point, like he wouldn't smile even in the hospital. And even on those days, it was two or three days in, and then he was right back to his normal self, even though we were there 7, 8, 9, 10 days. Even though he wasn't feeling well, he was always happy and smiling and willing to goof off and giggle about things and all that stuff. But he showed me that even though the mountain in front of you may be insurmountable, you can still get to the summit of it. And he showed me that the steps don't have to be big. It's similar to like those people that climb Mount Everest. If you ever watch anything on it, they don't climb it in one day. They climb up a certain distance and then they go to a base camp and they relax and they catch their breath and they get prepared for the next step. And then they go more and go to a base camp and they continue doing that till they get to wherever their last base camp is. And then you get to the point where I've got to decide either I'm going to do it or I'm not. And that's what I try to tell people what this life has been like as it relates to special needs and even as it relates to grief and dealing with loss is, yeah, you're going to have those uphill climbs and those tough moments and all that, but you're also going to have those times where you're going to, even though you may not be 100% happy, you're going to have those times where you can at least rest, even though there's a dull melancholy always there. He just showed me how to take just issues head on is the biggest thing that he showed me.
Yeah, it sounds like he is a great teacher to you and continues to be a great teacher to you, which leads me to the next piece. I know you have found a lot of comfort in writing about your grief. Mm-hmm. I also know that led to the creation of a Facebook page called Letters to Zachary, which I mm-hmm. know has gotten a tremendous response from people mm-hmm. all over the world.
Yep.
How have you found writing to be therapeutic? And what has been the response to your Letters to Zachary page? What have been some of the comments you've gotten? And how do you believe it's had a positive impact on those who have read those letters or your writings?
The irony of the whole start of the page was I was seeing a counselor at the time, and I'm a very big proponent of counseling. I've been on and off for years when I've had seasons that I've needed it. And right after my son passed away, I was seeing her explaining everything that was going on. And her comment to me one day was, have you ever thought about journaling? And I'll never forget it. I go, you know what? I don't know if I'm a great writer. I don't know if that's my thing. I don't know. It was my response to her. But the journaling has become very cathartic. It's become relieving, meaning I'm like a lot of men, but definitely me, I'm the type of person that I internalize it and I hold it in and it swirls in my brain 1,000 times and drives me crazy. And so if I can write it and get it on a page and out of my brain, then I can almost forget about it. I'll never really forget about it, but at least the constant and intense just swirling will leave me alone is what will happen. And even my counselor was just like, even if you write it just to yourself and say one day you decide to print them out and just burn them, at least at that point you can get them out and it's not just sitting in there just pressing on you. And so honestly, I didn't start journaling for a couple of months afterwards. And then just one day I got on my laptop and I opened a Word document and in letter form, like I wrote the date and Dear Zachary, and in letter form, I just wrote how I felt. And when I say I wrote how I felt in the moment, you can see in some of those first probably several months of letters how intense and vitriolic they are and the vulgarity in them and just the sense of just anger in them. Now, over time, even my mother has said you can see the evolution from when you first started to where you are now and how much it's changed and how much it's helped getting all of this out. So that's how it all started. As for the online stuff, I'm a researcher. And so when everything happened, I got onto Facebook, and as well as I do and everybody else says, you can find a group for anything. So I got on Facebook and I researched grief, and I actually found a small group that was parents who've lost a special needs child, which I wasn't expecting to find. I figured I'd find loss of a child and grief and that kind of stuff, but not that specific. And so I became a member and got to know the admin really well. And I eventually, at this point, I'm adminning the same group. So I got to know the other admin, and I said one day, I said, I journaled. Do you mind if I post some of my entries? And she said, no, please do. I posted one of my first one, and I prefaced it with, hey, I don't sugarcoat. I'm very open. I'm very raw. If you cannot handle raw emotion or maybe even vulgarity at times, please keep scrolling. I almost immediately got a response. It surprised me. And I've never been one to toot my own horn or anything, but I had women in this group go, I have never told anybody my true emotion about how I feel about the loss of my child. And you are the first person to put it in written form. What you have written in this letter is exactly how I feel to the letter. And I said, I appreciate that I can write something that resonates with you. And I said, honestly, this is my son inspiring me and me trying to create his legacy. So I continue to do this on and off for several months. And every time I'm getting this response, and it surprised me. And about the last time I do it, I go, you know what? Maybe I have something here in this writing. And the other admin of the group goes, have you ever considered writing a book? And I said, I've thought about it, but I don't know if my brain space can handle it at this point. And I said, I honestly didn't have enough material for what I would consider to be enough for a book. Now I do, but at that point I didn't. And I said, I may do that at a later date, but right now I don't have the mental power for it. And so several things were asked. And then someone finally just said, have you ever thought about making just a Facebook page, like a blogging page? And she goes, if you can do that, she said, at least at that point you can copy and paste what you're doing in there. And then you build a following if that's what you really want to do. And I went, you know what? I could do that. And so I made letters to Zachary, and like any page in the beginning, I had probably 10 or 20 followers, that kind of thing. And I just one day out of my head, just with the fact that I'm big into research and promotion and that kind of stuff, I went, you know what? I'm going to email some of what I would consider the big names in the grief community, like some of the writers and the David Kesslers kind of people, and just say, hey, my name is so-and-so. I've created this. Can you just give me positive hints of things that worked well for you, things that you've done that you thought, hey, that didn't work so well, so I can get a framework of kind of the direction I would like to go. And literally everybody I contacted was phenomenal about it. In fact, the biggest one, I don't know if you've heard of her, but there's an author by the name of Donna Ashworth that writes grief in prose form. She's had several books that at least over in Scotland have done really well. I think they've done well over here. And so she came back, she went, sure, what do you want to do? And we talked about it. And she said, if you want to go this way, you might want to try A, B, and C. If you want to go this way, you might want to try this way. And I said, okay, thank you. And all of them were that way. Initially, this page was for just men because my frustration was I kept getting into all these different grief groups. And Now, granted, I know I'm an anomaly. I'm always online. I'm always doing stuff. So I get that not all men are like me. Most men work different hours than I do, that kind of stuff. But even when I was on there, I could never get any men like me that were willing to at least share. Now, were they going to be exactly like losing a special needs child? No, I wasn't expecting that. But what I was expecting was, say, a father that had lost a child, a son, maybe a teenager that could, in a roundabout way, understand. And then one of the people I talked to said, it's great that you want to do just men, but if you're really looking to build an audience, you're going to have to open it up more. Because ultimately the goal for me is to get like some of these pages where they've got 5 digits of followers, that kind of thing. So at that point, I opened it up to women and people that lost a child, people that lost a parent, sibling, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so its main focus is still dealing with men and emotion, at least by my example, to say, hey, you may not know anybody out there, but I'm a man. I'm middle-aged. I'm Gen X. I grew up in a generation where it's difficult to share emotion. If you've got questions, come talk to me. I've also opened it up to women to say, hey, a lot of you have said, my husband, we lost our child several years ago. My husband's not opening up. What do I need to do? So I've opened it up to give women some insight into the mind of at least one man and how we grieve, how we process it, what we do when we do want to talk, when we don't want to talk, that kind of thing. And so that's how it's completely evolved. So as for the reach, as of 2 days ago, I just eclipsed over 1,000 followers on the page, and that's in under 8 months. And I have representation in 44 of the 50 U.S. states, no, 46 of the 50 U.S. states and 18 countries.
That's impressive. What I like about what you're doing is, one, just with the impact of journaling, like you said, it gives you a record of where you are in early grief. Mm-hmm. And as you progress, you can see the progress that you've made. You can go back and look and compare. The other thing is the fact that it's an anomaly for many men to be open with their grief journeys, because that's one of the things that men have had trouble traditionally with, is opening up, asking for support, and receiving support. And also the fact that you've opened up to women, I think, is wise, because the question is, how do I deal with a man who doesn't talk about his feeling? Mm-hmm. So from a male perspective, you can give them an understanding of, yeah, we grieve, we feel just as intensely, but it's a lot different.
Yes.
We deal with it differently.
Yeah.
If you can understand that, then you can witness how we can grieve effectively, mm-hmm. and we can build stronger relationships. And the other thing is that a hope is that relationships will strengthen after the death of a child, as opposed to go apart. So what you're doing is, I think you're providing information for both men and women to re-engage in a relationship in a world that's different. It's providing a valuable service, Jason.
Certainly. I jokingly tell people, I said, I'm building the foundation of my grief empire, so to speak, is what I'm trying to do. I at this point, I've done multiple podcasts on it. I've collaborated with at least, there's one big name, at least on TikTok, I've already collaborated with several times on. For that, I'm looking to evolve into public speaking, although that's been a little bit difficult for me to get my foot in the door. I've done all the locally trying to talk to churches and Kiwanis clubs and Toastmasters and all those kind of things and trying to get in there. I've even submitted for a TEDx talk. I'd love to get to where I can publicly speak on it, but that hasn't happened quite yet. That's my next kind of goal outside of what I'm currently doing.
Let me tell you, one of the things I've discovered in my own journey is that intention is a very powerful form of prayer. So if you've said this is what you want to do, mm-hmm. keep your eyes open, and maybe the universe will open up some opportunities for you to do that. And I think you're a great speaker now, and I think the podcast platform is going to help you refine that. So with that, Jason, I have one last question for you today. And first of all, thank you. It's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed spending time with you today. How can our listeners, viewers, get in touch with you? What's the best way for them to do that?
And like anybody in today's social media world, I'm basically on all platforms. My main page is on Facebook. It's called Letters to Zachary. The two is T-O, not the number. And Zachary is spelled Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y. So Letters to Zachary on Facebook is my main one, where I post everything from the beginning. I'm also on TikTok, Twitter, or now X, Instagram, and YouTube. Now those other four, it's Letters to Zachary, but it's the number two for the other four, just because I couldn't get it that way on the other ones. Those are my main ways to get a hold of me. Right now, like I say, right now, my two biggest ones are Facebook, and I've gotten bigger on TikTok just because I've learned there's a large grief community on TikTok. So if your listeners like a little more the video format style, typically most of my videos on there are 5 minutes or less. They're not real long. There are a couple of them that'll get a little north of 5 minutes on there. I don't read my letters out, but I have just when I have grief moments, and there's typically a lot of things like where I'm asking questions on there. Like, for example, like the other day I asked a question, something to the effect of, ladies, if you could ask your, if there's one thing you could know from your husband or your male partner about their grief journey, what would it be? So I'll ask questions like that just to create conversation, that kind of thing on there.
Thank you, Jason. And thank you again for being such a, you're welcome. And, for, and thank you for being such a valuable guest contributor today to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Certainly, anytime.
Thank you. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.